Case number 11-1324, Ali Hamza Ahmed Suleiman al-Balul, petitioner versus United States of America. Mr. Paradis for the petitioner, Mr. Depew for the respondent.
Before we begin, we're a little hot up here. Can you see if we can get some air in here? All right, Ben. All right, Mr. Paradis.
Good morning, Judge Henderson, Judge Tatel, Judge Rogers, and may it please the court. I'd like to make two principal points this morning. The first is that the Constitution puts two necessary conditions on the subject matter jurisdiction of law of war military commissions. The charge must, in fact, be an offense under the law of war, that branch of international law governing hostilities, and the charge must not be of a crime that entailed a jury trial right at common law. Conspiracy, the standalone crime of entering into a tortious or criminal agreement, fails both conditions. The government concedes that it is not a war crime, at least as that term is ordinarily understood. And conspiracy is a paradigm example of a crime, indeed an infamous crime, that entails the full deliberation of a jury trial under the Constitution. Now, the government asks for a new rule. And under that rule, the invocation of the war powers answers any limits that Article 1, Article 3, or really any other part of the Constitution might put on its ability to bring domestic crimes into special trial chambers run by the Department of Defense.
Let me ask you to just step back for a minute. Your brief, you treat the Article 1 and Article 3 arguments in separate sections.
Yes, Your Honor.
Do you think they're separate arguments?
Yes, Your Honor.
Can you prevail on, in other words, can we deal with Article 3 without getting into Article 1 and vice versa?
Yes, you can.
Go ahead and tell me how you can do that.
Yes, they're both necessary conditions. The Supreme Court lays that out pretty clearly in ex parte Curin. We would point the court specifically to page 29, where the court says, and I'm paraphrasing a little bit, that there may be offenses under international law that are recognized abroad that are not triable by military commission here, either because we don't recognize it as a violation of international law, or because it is of the class of offense that is only triable by jury.
Right. Here's why I asked my question. So in response to your Article 3 argument, one of the government's responses is, well, Congress's authority to create commissions and establish their jurisdiction comes not from the Define and Punish Clause, but the congressional war authority in Article 1. And so we have to deal with that argument, don't we? In response to your Article 3 argument, they say the Article 1 power, war-making powers, are not limited in that way.
Well, I think the government...
So doesn't that just bring us right into Article 1, even if we're considering Article 3?
No, and I would point to... I would give you this court an example that I think the government would answer potentially the Article 1 question, but would under no circumstances be triable in a military commission in this country, and that's the crime of treason. Treason is inherently tied up in the war powers. There are arguments that certain types of treason are recognized as offenses under international law, yet treason is not triable, is only triable, in fact, in an Article III court. And the precedents on that go back to the Civil War, including some of the military commissions the government has cited, at least at earlier phases in this litigation. General Halleck in Missouri threw out convictions for treason on the ground that treason itself, treason proper, is only triable by a court of law. So yes, they are independent conditions, and that's what the Supreme Court held in Curin. And in fact, in setting that out, Curin relied specifically on ex parte Milligan. That was the court's analysis in ex parte Milligan. They said this fact that the offenses are only triable by jury is precisely why we had to vacate an ex parte Milligan, but not vacate here. And I think it's important for this court to just keep in mind that when the Supreme Court said that, Ex parte Milligan is a conspiracy case. That is the first charge. That was the primary charge against Milligan. And so when the Supreme Court in Kieran is holding up Milligan as the paradigm case of a crime triable only by jury, they're looking to a conspiracy case.
I thought your point about treason was interesting. Suppose, which leads me to wonder, suppose because of the war on terror and the developments in the world, suppose eventually the international community recognizes conspiracy as a war, international law, war violation mm-hmm. of a law, and it's recognized as such by the international community. Would Congress then be able to have military commissions try conspiracy claims, or would you still have an Article III problem?
Under Kieran, you'd still have the Article III problem. The precise problem with conspiracy that Ex parte Kieran points out. And I would point out, too, the second case the Supreme Court relied on in Kieran for, again, the parameters, the bounds of Article III is Callan versus Wilson, which is a D.C. case and dealing with the D.C. police court and is also a conspiracy case. And in that the question was whether or not conspiring to commit a petty offense, petty offenses being triable outside the ordinary jury requirements, like spying and aiding the enemy, that a conspiracy to commit one of those offenses does trigger the Article III entitlements to trial by jury and a federal judge. And that in part is because of the nature of proving a conspiracy. In an ordinary crime, particularly in a war crime, there's no doubt that a crime occurred. And typically the proving the corpus delicti is the government's simplest task in an ordinary criminal prosecution, and then the rest of the trial is whether or not this individual perpetrated that crime. Mm-hmm. Whereas in a conspiracy, the vast majority of the evidence the government is going to put forward is proving that a crime even happened. And it's all through circumstantial evidence, it's all through implication and sort of understanding what was the intent of the various actors at the given time, whether or not that intent was specific. A number of questions that are both delicate in their evidentiary, in the evidentiary demands that we put on them, and that are things that federal courts do every day, and that military commissions are really quite inappropriate for, primarily because their rules of evidence are so much more lax than ordinary courts are. Again, primarily because in a war crimes context, there's no question there's a crime. It's just proving this individual was tied to this crime.
You're not taking the position, are you, that Kieran holds that the law of war is limited to the international law?
We are.
You think it holds that?
Yes. Sorry.
Well, go ahead. Let me just ask you, how can you make that argument given the fact that Kieran at the end says we hold only that exception one was sufficient? Sufficient to invoke the constitutional jurisdiction of the commission. Mm-hmm. And that was a clear violation of the law of war. It didn't require any resort to domestic law at all. That's the holding of Kieran, isn't it?
Yes, they hold that the first charge, right. Perfidious sabotage, was an offense under the law of war, under international law.
Right, and Kieran didn't have to explore at all whether there was something beyond the international law of war, like an American comment. It didn't have to consider that.
Well, they certainly didn't consider it.
Why I'm asking you what the holding of the case is from our perspective.
Well, the holding of the court was to say that the law of war is a branch of international law, and we look to that branch of international law in order to assess.
My point is it didn't take the next step and say it's limited to the international law. It didn't have to resolve the issue before.
It didn't have to, but no one until this case ever suggested that there was anything other than the international law of war.
Well, doesn't that make the point even stronger then, that it could not have resolved this issue if it wasn't raised then?
Well, if it did not resolve that issue, the government bears an enormous burden of demonstrating that literally every authority on the law of war from this country, from abroad, from anywhere else, is wrong to treat it as a branch of international law. And I would point specifically to the government's own manual and not manual, excuse me, directive on detainee treatment, which was promulgated after we submitted our briefing, but we do quote it in our reply brief, which says the law of war is and only is the international law governing the conduct of hostilities, detention operations, et cetera, and with no mention of some other branch of international law. And I think if the government is going to make this argument.
Okay, you're going beyond Kieran at this point. I was just
saying. Oh, sure, yeah. Kieran.
So do you want to say anything about the government's argument about Hamdan? And that is that, that what did they say? They said at least, I think they said, seven justices said that we should look to the American common law for Hamdan.
That's simply not correct.
I thought you might say that, but why?
Well, I would first cite to Justice Thomas's opinion and say that the one question on which there was unanimity in Hamdan, the one question, was that the law of war is international law. And Justice Thomas says quite explicitly that we do not, the law of war is not domestic law. We look to the law and the practices of civilized nations of which the United States is a part. Mm-hmm. And so when the United States, when Kieran or Hamdan or any other case looks to domestic practice, they're looking to domestic practice implementing international law, just like Justice Thomas said. And when Justice Stevens refers to the American common law of war, he's talking about procedural law. He's talking about the constraints that statutes and the Constitution may put on how we conduct war, not on not some separate body of substantive law that we can resurrect and send to military commissions. And so, again, the government is embracing a truly radical position in attempting to redefine the law of war in a way that not only is unprecedented, not only that they have no authority to support, but that is contrary to the basic purposes and logic of the law of war being those minimal rules, those basic rules that all nations, all actors in an armed conflict must share and must respect. And if there's an American common law of war, it's easy to say that there's going to be a Russian common law of war. There's going to be a Syrian common law of war. And the very purpose of the law of war, setting minimal standards for humanity, is going to be thwarted by that. And
then what's your reaction to the government's argument that if we agree with you, we'll be casting constitutional doubt on some of the most important military commission decisions in U.S. history, including the Lincoln, the trial of Lincoln?
If anyone is casting doubt on the most important military commissions in history, it is the government. In fact, the government's entire case depends on this court effectively overturning Kieran on one of two points. This court, either the Supreme Court was wrong to say that spying is a violation of the international laws of war, or the court was wrong to say that the international laws of war govern the subject matter jurisdiction of a law of war military commission. And
well, you're only right on the second point, if that's in fact what Kieran held, going back to our earlier discussion.
I'm sorry, I didn't understand.
I said your second point is correct only if you're right that Kieran, in fact, held that military commissions are limited to violations of the international law.
Yes, of course. Right. But
what about my question about the Lincoln, the commission that tried the Lincoln assassins? They make a very persistent argument in their briefs that, you know, if we agree with you, then that will be suggesting that entire process was unconstitutional.
Not in the least, I think, is our simple answer. Mm-hmm. And that's because the Lincoln conspirators, as they call them, or as the Lincoln assassins, as they were called at the time, were not tried for conspiracy, either as a standalone offense or as an offense, even as a co-ed offense. They were tried for assassinating the president. There was one charge against them. It was assassination. They were alleged to have conspired and aided, abetted, and been an accessory to, and pretty much every other theory of liability that could get them to be liable for the assassination, but none of them were charged with conspiracy as a standalone offense. And what makes that the most obvious is, well, there are two points. One is when the Attorney General reviewed the case, he doesn't mention the word conspiracy. He says, you have asked me to review whether it was lawful to try the assassins of Abraham Lincoln with the offense of assassinating the president. But I think the second and the more compelling reason is that this is an anachronistic view of the law of conspiracy. The law of conspiracy in the 1860s was a misdemeanor. It was a misdemeanor that carried a maximum sentence of 2 years. And It could not be, in fact, charged with a completed a crime because of doctrines of merger. And so any crime that was – anyone who was charged with a substantive conspiracy offense and a completed felony was actually just charged with a completed felony. And, in fact, and there was even authority saying that trying to charge both in the same document would render the indictment itself defective. And so no one would have thought in the 19th century that the conspirators are charged with the offense of conspiracy. And I think that's also proven out by – and we point this out in our brief. John Surratt, the last assassin who escaped military commission prosecution, he was ultimately tried in a federal court a few years later. The same language is in his indictment, and that's important because that indictment was issued before there was a federal conspiracy statute. And so no one at the time would have viewed that as a standalone conspiracy offense, if only because it would have been absurdly lenient. If anyone is casting doubt on any precedent, again, it is the government who is anachronistically applying modern legal concepts, modern thought about spying and conspiracy retroactively to pre-modern times. And ultimately, if this case is going to turn on anachronism, we lose. But if this case is going to turn on what the law is today, what the Supreme Court has clearly held, and what has been reaffirmed in case after case, be it Yamashita, Eisentrager, or Hamdan, then we prevail. And the government knows that. And that is why it is attempting to look at history through a lens darkly and to confuse the issues in this court, that they have stipulated that the offense here is not a violation of the law of war, and there is Supreme Court precedent, including Kieran, holding that conspiracy is an offense that is only triable by jury under Article III.
I just want to pursue this one question about Kieran. Suppose we don't agree with you that Kieran holds that it's limited to the international law. Suppose we don't agree with you about that.
Mm.
Then what?
Then the government still loses on the second prong. Even if the defined either because Congress has a broad swath of discretion under the Define and Punish Clause, or because there's just a class of offenses that can be tried in a military commission, irrespective of whether they are violations of under international law, you still have the massive Article III problem, which the government never overcomes, because that is a separate condition.
Then that brings me to a final question for you, which is that back to my original question about the fact that you argue Article 1 and 3 in separate sections of your brief.
Mm.
Which do you think – it sounds to me like you think, from what your answer to my last question, that you think the more powerful argument from Bellul's perspective is Article 3. Is that right?
I don't know if I would say it's more powerful, but I think it's certainly it's an argument the government has never even sought to overcome.
Which would you, if you were writing the opinion in this case, which would you start with?
I would start with Article 3, and here's what.
Does it make a difference? And the subsidiary question to that does your Article 1 and Article 3 issues make a difference in terms of our standard of review?
I think if there is any difference, we don't think there is a difference. But if there were to be any
difference,
Article 3 obviously has the highest and most de novo standard of review possible, both because there was no express waiver of the jury trial right, and most importantly, that's a question that goes right to the court's independent duty to ensure that the executive branch is not essentially sidelining the courts in the prosecution of the trial of all or in the trial of all crimes. That's a core judicial function, and be it Stern v. Marshall, be it Northern Pipeline, be it ex parte Kieran, the courts must have an independent duty to protect their turf, so to speak, and to protect the sanctity of judicial trials. This is a core separation of power problem, and if Congress and the political branches can send conspiracy, that sort of archetypical common law organized crime offense, if they can sign such a domestic offense as conspiracy to a military commission, there are no limits. And that is ultimately something that is fundamentally dangerous to the basic structure of our government and having an independent judiciary. I see that my time has expired. I did have one other point, but if Your Honors
go ahead.
The second major point I would like to make is, and this is tied to the government's invocation of the war powers more broadly, is that this court is being asked, the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals is being asked to embrace the segregation of the justice system for the first time in U.S. history. And this court has been given no rational, let alone compelling reason to embrace that segregation.
Didn't Karen do that?
I'm sorry?
Didn't Karen do that? Isn't that what Karen did?
Not at all. There were two citizens who were tried in ex parte Karen.
Yeah.
And the Supreme Court squarely held in, I think it's around page 45, that citizenship does not matter when it comes to the jurisdiction of a military commission. Mm-hmm. And they were relying on an unbroken line of precedent, unbroken until today, of subjecting our own people, our own citizens, to those to whom our legislature is politically accountable, to the same laws, procedures, and rules that everyone else is. And if there is any other attack that could be had on the American justice system, it is this one, on the basic bedrock principle, the organizing principle of our entire justice system, which is equal justice under law. And if this court looks at the legislative history, there's no doubt that Congress understood that they were abrogating that. And moreover, they were explicit that if two individuals were arrested at the same time for committing the same offense, no other distinction between them. The one with the U.S. passport would be sent to a federal court. The one without one would be sent to Guantanamo for a deliberately and meticulously inferior criminal justice process. And so unlike ex parte hearing, unlike any court system, military or civilian, in our nation's history.
What do you do with our decision in Canada?
I'm sorry, I didn't
hear you. What do you do with, with this court's Canada decision, which says the Fifth Amendment doesn't apply?
This court's decision, that's a civil case. This is a criminal case. And more specifically, Wong Wing versus the United States squarely answers the question at issue here. Wong Wing, the Chinese Exclusion Act, was the only time in U.S. history when Congress attempted to segregate the justice system. And it directed illegal aliens for trial for violating the immigration laws to commissioners, is what they called them. And in Wong Wing, the Supreme Court said that relying on Yickwo versus Tompkins, so this is an equal protection case, said that the Fifth Amendment does not allow the federal government to discriminate on any basis, when it challenges something as fundamental as equal justice under law and the right to a jury trial. And that, it's difficult to...
What's our standard I hate to be technical.
No.
What is our standard of review on that issue?
On this issue, it's clearly de novo, and that's because of all the issues raised today. Ballou did raise this issue. He raised it squarely. He raised it in writing. Mm-hmm. And the only reason we don't have his written objection on this issue is because the government lost it. We know that the objection was made primarily from a fragment of transcript that was entered into the record in place of his written objections. But objection 7, it's on a page 114 of our appendix, he squarely objects to the military commissions on the ground that they discriminate against, they discriminate on the basis of nationality. That's his language. And this transcript, particularly the transcript from Arabic, is very difficult to read. The translation quality is very uneven. But that point is clear. He raised this issue. He raised it in his first military commission, and he raised it again attempted to raise it again. And so if nothing else, this issue is raised by the accused and subject to de novo review. And I would simply say, even if that was not satisfactory, personal jurisdiction is a question that in military tribunals is always subject to de novo review. It's just a feature.
So your answer to Kimba is that was a habeas case?
That's correct. It was a civil action where an individual is asserting a right against the government positively.
But doesn't the case hold that the Due Process Clause does not apply to Guantanamo?
The Due Process Clause does not apply, again, to a habeas petitioner or to habeas proceedings in Guantanamo. I think it's a pretty radical thing to say, and I don't think this court could say that the Due Process Clause does not apply in a criminal prosecution, because that would, again, run headlong into Wong Wing, which holds that the Fifth Amendment applies to any prosecution of any individual who is brought into the jurisdiction of the United States. Wong Wing could not be clearer about that. And again, it was dealing not, you know, like the war powers, with the immigration powers, an area where the political branch's power is at their apogee. And still, the Supreme Court said that when you go from the necessary conditions, when you go from the need to detain and to implement the immigration laws and to protect our borders, the courts will generally defer, and there very well may not be a significant due process right in that question. But when Congress goes that extra step here and invades the judicial power and says, we are going to now punish these individuals for infamous crimes, then the judicial power clicks in and is at its, and the authority of the courts becomes paramount over the political authority that the other branches may have. And I would just say, this law is extraordinary. We've never segregated the justice system. We didn't do it during Jim Crow. We didn't do it when we interned the Japanese. We didn't even do it during slavery. And so the government is asking this court, after offering it no reason, no rational basis, let alone a compelling justification, to say that justice here is separate and unequal. And the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals should not embrace for the first time in our history unequal justice under law, because that, in the American context, is a contradiction in terms. If we are going to apply the law, if we are going to apply the Constitution, it must be applied equally, and justice must be blind. If there are no further questions on that, I would...
All right, we'll give you a couple of minutes to respond.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. DePue.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. John DePue for the United States.
Just to finish up on this issue that we were just talking about, does the government address Wong Wing?
No, we have not, Your Honor.
Yeah. All right.
Mr. Ball's argument...
What is your response to the counsel just said about his equal protection argument?
First, at the outset, I would point out the fact that petitioner is simply incorrect in holding that this is a unique or novel proposition. Contemporaneously with the enactment of the Bill of Rights, the Congress enacted the Articles of War.
Do you agree with him that Kiamba is not binding on this issue?
Kiamba addressed the context of the civil litigation. Kiamba has never directly extended the question or addressed the question whether the Equal Protection Clause applies in the criminal context.
That's an open issue.
Yes, I believe it is an open issue, Your Honor, but I don't think we need to address it to reach this point, simply because as a historical matter, since the adoption of the Articles of War of 1806, Congress has distinguished between aliens and citizens with respect to their amenability to a trial by a military commission. Congress has historically viewed aliens and citizens, particularly during a time of an armed conflict, differently. And Congress had a rational basis for doing so here. After all, the Military Commissions Act of 1906 was enacted in the context of the attack of 9/11. It was enacted in contemplation of the fact that most of the individuals who would be rounded up and subject to military proceedings would be aliens. And it was adopted in the context of concern that in the basis of recent legal events, there may be a basis for distinguishing in the panoply of procedural safeguards between citizens and aliens. It was suggested in the Verdugo case. It was suggested in this court in the Alviani case. So the court acted rationally in making this decision. But what I think is important to understand is that the Military Commissions Act and the procedural safeguards that it provides are almost as robust as those that apply to American soldiers who are subject to trial by court-martial. The only relevant distinctions, different hearsay rule, and the inability to invoke Miranda safeguards have absolutely no bearing in the context of this case because petitioner got up on the stand, admitted that he committed all the acts that he was charged with judicially, and then went on to boast about the fact that he was proud about the fact that he had been involved in 9/11. So I think there's plenty of rational basis here, and even if there weren't, the petitioner was not prejudiced as a result of the proceedings that occurred. But petitioner's argument founders on his mistaken reasoning that the Define and Punish Clause constitutes the exclusive basis for reaching offenses and codifying them as violations of a law of war and subjecting the individuals who are the subjects to trial by a military commission.
On that last point,
in
your brief at page 50, are you conceding that the Article 3 issue is non-forfeitable?
Your Honor, I think there are two components to the Article 3 argument. The first part is the defendant's right to a jury trial.
I'm really focusing on the second part.
The second part is a structural argument, and we do not believe that that is forfeitable because it relates to the court's authority to adjudicate cases.
And you acknowledge he is raising it?
I do not acknowledge that he was raising it. We don't read the record in the same way he
did. Well, your brief says, to the extent Ballul raises such a structural.
I'll concede.
I just want to be clear what the government's position is on this.
I think that with respect to the equal protection component, the structural component, it is not a waivable or forfeitable claim.
But you agree the Article 3 is not forfeitable. Is that what you're saying?
No, I don't. I'm sorry.
I thought that's what you said.
Yes, I do.
To Judge Rogers.
I do not agree that the Article 3 has been forfeited. We don't read the record that way.
No, I'm asking you whether, I thought in response to your question, you said you agreed that it could not be forfeited, that it was structural.
Yes.
You agree with that?
The structural component of that argument is forfeitable, and it's really kind of irrelevant whether the jury trial right is forfeitable because you have to reach it because it's a forfeitable matter under this court's recent decision in Koretsky versus Commissioner. I think where...
What do you do about the cases?
Can we just clarify the government's position here? Because I've heard two different answers. Are you saying that the personal individual right to a jury trial is a right that is forfeitable?
Yes.
Are you also saying that the structural Article 3 claim is forfeitable?
I am saying that argument is not forfeitable.
Yes, thank you.
That goes to this court's authority.
And so what are the consequences of that for our standard of review? Let's assume we take up the Article 3 argument first. You agree then that we're de novo?
With respect to the structural argument, that's de novo. With respect to the right to a jury trial.
How can you separate them?
I don't believe you can.
You can't, right? So,
as a practical matter, I don't believe you can separate.
Okay, so then on that issue, we're looking at this de novo.
Yes.
Correct?
Yes.
Okay.
And let's proceed with that issue.
Okay, that's good.
I think the answer to that is that the answer to both parts of that question is the manner in which petitioner characterizes the conspiracy. He says that it encroaches on this court's Article 3 authority. Because it's nothing more than a run-of-the-mill common law conspiracy of the type that the Article III courts typically adjudicate under Title 18. Nothing could be further from the truth. The conspiracy alleged in this case is a conspiracy to commit the most quintessential and obvious violations of the law of war that there are. Murder of civilians, attacking civilian targets, committing acts of terrorism as a mode of warfare.
What about the inchoate conspiracy and the acts, the overt acts that were charged?
There were 10 overt acts alleged. All were found to have been proven by the government or by the finder of fact.
Except one. He was found not guilty.
Except one that involved wearing a grenade belt.
And that was the only law of war offense.
No, it was not the only law of war offense. All of the
others. The overt acts, which were traveling, which were training, what else was a law of war offense of the overt acts?
Assisting and participating in the attacks in preparation of the acts of terrorism, making the film, training others and inducing others to commit violations of the law of war.
I don't think that's the way the charge reads, but in any event, proceed with your argument. Yeah.
Well,
so are you now, let me just follow up. So is it the government's position that you don't need to, you don't need to argue that the jurisdiction of the military commission is not limited by international law. That is, you know, with your argument that we should look to the domestic common law, you don't need that argument? Is that what you were just saying?
Of course we need.
I thought you said that the conspiracy charged here was, in fact, a violation of international law. I thought your briefs conceded that it wasn't.
I'm saying that the overt acts that were the target offenses charged in the conspiracy were plain violations of the law of war.
The incomplete conspiracy charge, an incompleted conspiracy is not a violation, right?
That's correct, Your Honor. We've conceded and we've acknowledged that before.
Okay.
But the question
is. For this court to agree with the government, we have to go beyond the international law, correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay. And that brings us to Kiran.
It brings us first to the proposition that is, the courts have recognized repeatedly that both define and punish clause does not constitute the exclusive basis on which Congress is empowered to allege offenses as war crimes cognizable by military commission.
Uh-huh. And so let's assume you're right about that. Is there any limiting principle?
Yes, absolutely.
What is it?
Absolutely, Your Honor. And I think the limiting principles are contained in the Quirin case, the Quirin decision itself. The distinctive nature of the offense and the offender. The offender must be an unlawful enemy, an enemy belligerent.
Right. Do you think that's what Quirin's about? I thought Quirin used that language simply to describe who had committed the violations of the law.
That's right, but I think it's a legitimate limiting principle. Uh-huh. Who's the offender? An enemy belligerent. What's the nature of the offense? The nature of the offense is a scheme to commit an offense related to the commission, to the armed conflict, which is what distinguishes this from the cases the petitioner cited.
And what's your best authority for the proposition that the Define and Punish Clause is not, it doesn't limit Congress's authority? Well, is it Quirin? What's the best authority you have for that?
Because
I'm not sure Quirin, as I read Quirin, Quirin is definitely not the clearest opinion.
No, it's not.
When Quirin is talking about Congress's power to establish the commission, you're totally right. It's talking about Congress's authority, its war powers under Article I. But wherever the opinion is talking about the jurisdiction of the commission Congress creates, it seems to talk about the Define and Punish Clause.
Quirin begins its discussion by acknowledging the fact that that the constitutional war powers rest in that.
That's what I just said.
Yeah.
You're totally right about that. But when you get into the body of Quirin, and it's talking about the jurisdiction of the commission, it's talking about, here, I'll give you an example. Here's an example. After it says Congress has the authority, as you just pointed out properly, to create these commissions under its war power, it then says, here, Congress has thus exercised its authority to define and punish offenses against the law of nations by sanctioning within constitutional limitations the jurisdiction of military commissions. So when it gets into the jurisdictional questions, the actual authority, I read this as saying that they're looking at the Define and Punish Clause. Is that not right?
The way I read Quirin is to acknowledge the fact that the Define and Punish Clause recognizes the authority of the domestic courts to reach offenses such as spying that are not themselves violations of international law. The big problem that we have to confront with Quirin is that the offense...
Let me just read you the quote again. Let's stick with the language of Quirin. Congress has thus exercised its authority to define and punish offenses against the law of nations by sanctioning within constitutional limitations the, quote, I'm still in the quote, jurisdiction of military commissions to try persons for offenses, et cetera, et cetera. It's talking about jurisdiction. And it's talking about the define and punish clause. That's why I ask, what's your, is there another case that we should look at? If we're not convinced that Kieran resolves this, what other case is there that says that jurisdictional questions here are not limited by the define and punish clause?
I believe that Kieran is the source to which you would ordinarily look. Okay. But I would also say, with respect to the Kieran decision, that it recognized that spying was not a violation of international law. And the only way you can recognize that you can reconcile the passage that you have read with respect to the language in Kieran that recognizes that spying is not a violation.
Wait, I don't mean to interrupt you. Kieran expressly says that spying was a violation of the international law of war.
No, I don't agree with you in that respect, Your Honor.
You don't agree with Kieran?
Pardon?
You don't agree with Kieran? Or
I don't agree that Kieran said only that spying was a violation of international law.
No, I didn't say that. Kieran seems to say, Kieran operated on the assumption that spying was a violation of the international law, didn't it?
I don't believe that it did, no, Your Honor. I don't.
Quote, the spy who secretly and without uniform crosses the border, seeking to gather military intelligence and communicate it to the enemy, is a familiar example of a belligerent who is deemed an offender against the law of war. And then in footnote 9, it describes this 1787 trial of a British.
Major John Andre.
Yeah, and before a board that General Washington had set up, and it says, here's what the board said. The board found, I'm just reading from Kieran. The board found that he was a, quote, a spy from the enemy, and that agreeably to the law and usage of nations, he ought to suffer death. That's saying that this was a violation of, and I may have been wrong about that, right? But Kieran seems to me to rest on the proposition that spying is a violation.
I believe that when you begin with a quote that you have just excerpted with me, it begins by saying that our nation has always recognized the fact that these individuals are subject to trial by military commissions as violators of the law of war. And as you have also pointed out, that the sole authority that the Kieran court relied upon for that proposition were domestic precedents, starting with the trial of Major Andre back in 1780. The offense of spying was not then.
But I only cited it to you for the proposition that General Washington created board viewed spying as a violation of international law.
No, I would say that he viewed spying as an offense that the international law permits a nation to punish, not specifically that it was itself an international crime, as Judge Kavanaugh pointed out in his concurring opinion before the en banc court. Spying has never been viewed as a violation of international law. Spying is a crime that the international authorities recognize that a sovereign may punish, but not that it itself is a violation of international law. And I do not read Quirin to go beyond that.
So let me be very clear about this. I know you cite Judge Kavanaugh's opinion and you cite Winthrop, but Quirin is focused on Winthrop and describes the charge before it and spying in terms of the law of war. And in those days, at least, it was clear to the Supreme Court what that phrase meant.
I believe it was clear to everyone that the way the phrase law of war was typically used, even then, as Colonel Winthrop explained, embraced not only our nation's own law of war, but as supplemented by our longstanding traditions and practices. And one of those supplementations, of course, was to treat spying as a war crime subject to trial by military commission. Mm-hmm. So the law of war, the phrase law of war, to those people back then, embraced something broader than international war crimes. Mm-hmm. It embraced offenses that were permitted by our nation, for the practice of our nation to reach those offenses.
What's your best sentence in Kieran that says that? Tell me the best thing you've got in Kieran.
The sentence in Kieran beginning with the fact that the international law made cognizable by military commission the offense of spying. It didn't say it was a violation of international law. It said that it was cognizable, or that the international law permitted a sovereign that caught the spy to punish him.
So in this instance, where international law in that same vein has not permitted inchoate conspiracy, what happens to your analysis?
I would say that the same reasoning applies. As Professor Oppenheim explained in his treatise, there are quite a number of offenses, spying simply being one of them, that although they are not violations of international law themselves, the international law community permits to be reached and to be made cognizable by a nation's tribunal in the interest of self-protection.
And so I was assuming I wasn't challenging your assertion. I was merely asking you, what effect on your assertion is the fact that the international community has not made cognizable and has not permitted inchoate conspiracy to be charged?
The international community has yet to recognize the offense of inchoate conspiracy as an international war crime.
Well, it's pretty clear in Nuremberg that the judges were not going that way, and that many nations did not recognize conspiracy, and that the military commissions were looking for personal responsibility.
But surely, if we can reach the offense of spying by a military commission, it not being a violation of international law.
But you just told me it was cognizable.
Yeah, it's cognizable.
And I'm asking you, if the offense is not cognizable, if it's not permissible under international law, then what happens?
I don't think it matters a bit.
I thought. You have to say that, don't you?
I think the general principle is that, as Professor Oppenheim points out in his treatise, that nations can punish offenses as war crimes that are not violations of international law when those offenses have a palpable effect, when the offenses are committed by an enemy belligerent and they have a palpable effect on the integrity of the particular nation. And if you read Professor Oppenheim, conspiracy is clearly within the class that would be permitted to be reached, that the international law would permit to reach. But
isn't this the issue that the Supreme Court split on in Honda?
In Hamden.
Isn't it the issue that the justices who debated this issue split on?
They split on the question whether conspiracy was a violation of our domestic law of war. What I think is pertinent about Hamden is the fact that both Justice Stevens, who wrote the plurality opinion, and Justice Thomas, who wrote the dissent, had to consider not only whether the offense of conspiracy was a violation of international law, but also whether it was a violation of our own domestic law of war.
Well, but I think, as I read Hamden, the issue that the court decided the case on was whether or not the military commissions then violated procedural provisions Uniform Code of Military Justice, right?
Yes, sir.
So when the court was talking about domestic law, it was looking at domestic law, namely the Uniform Code of Military Justice, as a limitation on the creation of military commissions. I didn't read it as saying you could expand the power of a military commission by resort to domestic law. That question, I don't think, was even before the court. Or at least it wasn't decided on that basis, right?
No.
Do you agree with me about what the holding of Hamdan was?
Of course, there is no holding of Hamdan in Hamdan with respect to the offense of conspiracy.
Correct. And nor, but I was just responding to your question about the seven justices' use of the word domestic. And in terms of the holding of the case, the use of domestic law there was referring to procedural limitations imposed by the Uniform Code of Military Justice. And so would I be wrong in reading Hamdan as saying that military commissions are limited by both international law and domestic law? It doesn't hold that military commissions' jurisdictions can be expanded by a domestic common law.
I think you read it in this way. They had to look to Article 21, as you say, to determine whether this was a cognizable offense. Article 21, they read broadly enough to embrace not simply violations of international law, which is consistent with the legislative history from Article 21.
I'm sorry, what?
Pardon?
Would you say what you said again? Just
they had to reach the legislative history of Article 1 and of Article 21, and the language of Article 21 makes it quite apparent that what the drafters, what Congress was intending to do, was to embrace two classes of violations of the law of war: international law and, as the Judge Advocate General at the time testified, violations of our own domestic practices, so that when the plurality considered whether the status of conspiracy, it had to look to both categories. So in looking to that second category, where the judges, where the justices were in disarray as to the extent to which our domestic practices permitted us to reach conspiracy. But what is important about Quirin is that they all considered it essential to look not only at international law, but upon our domestic practices as well, which is precisely the same thing that the en banc court did in this case, relying upon that language in Hamdan. They looked to domestic practices in determining whether or not the ex post facto clause.
But we were operating under plain error.
Yes, you were.
Okay.
But you still found it necessary.
No, we didn't. We said that issue was unresolved. In fact, the en banc court said this question wasn't resolved by the Supreme Court. But because you could make an argument that there was a domestic law, it wasn't plain error. Isn't that what we said?
Yes, you certainly did. You certainly did, Your Honor. But the point remains that the court did have to look to both.
But only for purposes of plain error review.
Yeah, that's correct. Yeah. Right.
Are you having more questions, Judge Dale?
Just one more.
All right.
Let's go back to Quirin for a minute. I just want to ask you let me just find this, okay? Let me just ask you this question about Quirin and its impact on this court, on this non-Supreme Court, also non-Supreme Court. So I agree with you that Quirin does not hold that. I agree with the government that Quirin does not hold, at least I think I do, that military commissions are limited to the international law. That wasn't the issue before the court. But it's full of language that seems to suggest that it does. Every time it talks about the issue, it talks about the law of war in terms of the international law. It does it again and again throughout the opinion. So given that, and given that this issue, I don't read Hamdan as having resolved the issue, and given what the Supreme Court has said about narrowing any limits to Article III to the narrowest possible scope, how can, give me your best argument for how this panel can rule that, can hold that a military commission's jurisdiction is determined by both international law and the domestic law. Do you see my point?
Yes,
I do. Let me ask you a question about this appeals court, given the language of Curran and the failure of the Supreme Court to resolve this issue and the and its language about Article III.
Well, the first thing that
what's your best argument that we can adopt that?
The first thing that I would point about Curran and the language upon which you rely is the way the Curran Court uses the phrase "the law of war." Once again, I would invite the Court's attention to footnote 10 at page 32.
Well, you're fighting my question, right? I mean, I know, I read your brief, so I know your argument about this, but suppose I don't agree with you that that's the way you read Curran. That I read this as sentences like, well, there's lots of language in here that, the Congress has thus exercised its authority to define and punish offenses. We were talking about this sentence where by sanctioning, to try persons for offenses which, according to the rules and precepts of the law of nations, and more particularly the law of war, are cognizable. And it says that again and again. And so if I read that as sort of strong dictum from the Supreme Court, that the law of war is the international law, I agree with you, it doesn't hold that. And given that the Supreme Court couldn't resolve that question, what do we do? What does this court do? How do we go with your argument?
I would first point out, as I did earlier, that the phrase, I think, cognizable is quite important in that context. Uh-huh. Whether not necessarily violations of international law, but they can be, but there's nothing wrong with reaching them under international law. There's nothing wrong with reaching them. Uh-huh. The principle of Curran, it seems to me, is that if the offense at issue, their spying, even though it's not a violation of international law, if that offense is committed by an enemy belligerent during and in relation to an armed conflict with the United States, and it has a palpable effect on the nature of that conflict, the government's defined and the government's war powers permit it to reach that crime.
So, do I have to agree? So, suppose I don't agree with that reading of Curran. Can you still prevail?
I think we can. I think we can, Your Honor, by simply
saying. That's why I was asking what your best argument is.
You simply could, Your Honor, by saying that we're not really sure what Curran holds in this regard. We believe, however, that Congress's war powers are broad enough to permit us to reach this offense.
Yeah.
Even though the Supreme Court couldn't resolve that question.
Even though the Supreme Court didn't clearly resolve that question, I believe that you can reach it based upon the reasoning of the fact that we have traditionally, repeatedly made offenses cognizable by military commission that are not themselves violations of international law.
We have one group of justices who agree with you and another group who don't. And we have Curran, and the court has told us again and again we're supposed to leave it to the court to clean up its precedent. But you want us to do that.
Well, I would suggest that under the hypothetical that you have given me, the Supreme Court hasn't clearly ruled on it. It can be read either way. Uh-huh. And that you can read it in such a manner as it gives the government authorization or permits the government to reach offenses that are not themselves violations of international law when those offenses are committed by enemy belligerents during and in time of an armed conflict. And that power resides not in the Define and Punish Clause, but in the amalgam of Congress's constitutional war powers.
I just have a factual question. This goes beyond the record, but what percentage of Guantanamo detainees are subject only to conspiracy?
I am told that it's a handful, Your Honor. We're talking about the teens, I think.
The rest are all subject to...
The 9-11 defendants, Your Honor.
This is not a problem for that, right?
You remember the president's speech about who was at Guantanamo, and he characterized them in three categories. And where can you give me a cite for only a handful in response to...
I can't give you a citation.
That's right.
I'm just telling you what I've been told.
That's a hunch.
Actually, maybe I asked the question the wrong way. What percentage of detainees who are trialed before commissions are charged only with conspiracy?
I don't think any of them are at this point.
With only... Really?
Certainly we've... Certainly mm-hmm. the recent decision by... In the Hamdan case, yeah. it's kind of had a tendency to cause people to proceed with caution. But I would also suggest that this court ought to proceed with caution this particular issue, because there is a plethora of other offenses in the Military Commissions Act of 1909 that are probably subject to the same type of an attack or challenge that we have seen here, that are not themselves violations.
Well, we can't deal, can
I
we?
I understand.
But yes. I'm simply asking you that by looking at the class of people who are charged with conspiracy, does not create the end of
But all I want to be clear on is that this data you're giving us, it's just speculation at this point. Because the prosecutor has taken the view, reading Hamdan by the Supreme Court, that is more in line with Ballou's argument than the government's argument.
I think the prosecutor's view.
Well, I mean, it's in writing, so we can both read it.
But simply to look for a way around what one might perceive the implications of Hamdan to be. And one way of dealing with that problem is by suggesting that in some instances at least, the conspiracy offense alleges a consummated crime that is itself punishable, not punishable just as a conspiracy.
All right, thank you. Does Mr. Perez have any time left?
No.
All right. I should take 2 minutes. Take 2 minutes.
Just as a point of information, my understanding is that there are three active cases in Guantanamo. All of them charge substantive offenses, and I think two are capital.
Could you respond directly to the argument counsel just made about Cure?
Right.
Well, I was glad to hear, because I think this is actually a point of agreement between us, at least if I understood him correctly. Uh-huh. And it's that Kieran says, and I have the quote, that it is essential to look to both international law and domestic practice, and we would agree with that. It is essential to look to both. You have to ensure that the offense is recognized under international law and is subject to military trial or non-Article III trial, non-jury trial in the United States. Those are the two heads of our argument, and we agree with that.
Your point is it's not one or the other, it's both.
It's not one or the other, it's both. And it's not just my point. The Supreme Court in Yamashita only looks to international law. In Eisentrager, they only look to international law. And specifically with respect to the Define and Punish Clause colloquy you had with my friend, Congress only looked to the Define and Punish Clause, both when enacting the subject matter jurisdiction portions of the Military Commissions Act, as well as the War Crimes Act in 1996, citing, in fact, ex parte here. So this has been a relatively well-established principle of our law for about 80 years, and it's the government that is trying to sort of upend and go through the nits of Karen to make it more confusing than perhaps it is.
And what about our argument about spying?
I don't think it's possible to look at the history of international law scholarship, certainly leading up to Karen or the language of Karen, and find that spies, that at least the court viewed spying as an offense against international law. The clearest example of that is at footnote 12 of the court's opinion, where they say that spies are, I'm paraphrasing, under international law considered war criminals.
They say it in the text, too.
And they say it in the text, too. It's repeated throughout the case. And if you look to any of the scholarship, including the scholarship the government relies upon to say spying isn't a violation of the law of war, that scholarship looks to Kieran and says, oh, Kieran got it all wrong. And I guess my only point to this court would be Kieran is binding in this court. International legal scholars may be helpful, but at the end of the day, the Supreme Court is infallible because it's final. And the Supreme Court squarely held and has always been understood to hold that spying was a violation of international law, or at least, and I think more importantly to Judge Rogers' questions, an offense under international law. There's a modern trend, obviously, to view crimes entailing universal jurisdiction as the exclusive sweep of war crimes, but that certainly is not historically true. There are a variety of crimes under international law, like spying, which is the subject of the Hague Convention. So I think I've never fully understood, candidly, the government's arguments with respect to spying, given that history. The only other two or three points I would make, if you're with your Honor's permission, is this is a run-of-the-mill conspiracy, and this court held that in the earlier en banc decision. In order to hold that conspiracy did not violate the ex post facto clause, this court effectively ruled that this was, in effect, an assimilation of Section 2332. And to the extent that that is and has always been a domestic federal crime that is prosecuted nearly every day, this is then a run-of-the-mill conspiracy case. With respect to waiver, the only point I would add to what's been said already is the government waived waiver on the first two issues before the CMCR. These issues were squarely presented to the CMCR. The government argued waiver of our other issues, including ex post facto. But below, they said, we do not argue waiver or forfeiture or plain error with respect to the Article I and Article III issues. And so,
didn't the on-bank court reject that argument?
No. With respect to ex post facto, the government did argue waiver before the CMCR. And to the extent that that preserves a forfeiture objection, mm-hmm. sort of a fortiori, I think this court was reasonable in relying on that. Mm-hmm. Here, the government wanted clarity on these legal points below. I think it's now that they're doubting the strength of their legal arguments, that it is now that they're looking for procedural devices to weaken the standard of review that they must meet to demonstrate jurisdiction in the military commissions. And the only point, the last point I would make, with Your Honor's permission, is that they failed to give you any rational reason for segregating the justice system, not one. It was a carte blanche. The war powers is a talisman. We can discriminate. And that is belied in this context especially. Anwar al-Awlaki, we killed him with a drone. He was a U.S. citizen. And under this law, he would have had to have been tried in a federal court. Jose Padilla, captured in the Chicago Airport. Yasser Hamdi, held temporarily in Guantanamo. There's no rational reason to distinguish between citizens and non-citizens, particularly in a conflict, a non-international armed conflict. And so the controlling cases I would point this court to are not only Wong Wing and not only Plotler versus Doe, but Claiborne. This is Claiborne, where the government is asserting, well, there's a special issue, there's a special threat, without ever actually articulating or giving this court comfort that there is a reason to discriminate. Instead, this is a law that puts separate and unequal into our justice system. It violates what the Supreme Court has called the basic premise of our entire law, equal justice under law. And that is unconstitutional. And this court should hold that. And if there are no further questions, I would reserve the remainder of my time.